Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today we talk wine with a man who bucks trends. He's importer Kermit Lynch, a cult figure to a lot of wine lovers. In the 1970s, Kermit opened a wine shop in Berkeley, California, and that's where the journey began. Our wilting violet cheesemonger, Steve Jenkins, names the best cheddar in America. The man of the golden palate, David Rosengarten, chimes in with his three top cookbooks of the year, all by the same person, no less. For everyone quavering at the thought of baking, we have baking tips from Fine Cooking Magazine. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column for Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you'll never guess what we did.
What did you do?
We left the United States. Michael and I actually went somewhere. We went to Calgary, Canada, which I will tell you right now is pronounced Calgary, not Calgary. That's a terrible faux pas.
Well, thank you. Because
you're welcome.
I don't want to say how I've been pronouncing it. But what took you out of the United States? I'm really stunned.
Well, it's sort of silly because the main reason we went to Calgary was to eat beef. Calgary, Alberta in particular, is absolutely passionate about beef. And there are many restaurants in the city of Calgary that make a big deal out of serving Alberta beef. Some of the connoisseurs of Alberta beef there will tell you they can taste the difference between a steak cut from an Alberta cow and one from an Iowa or Texas cow, because the Alberta one is that much better.
That's really challenging words, considering the beef in the United States.
Interestingly enough, we found beef not just as steaks or in fine restaurants, of which there really are quite a few in Calgary, but I think our favorite run-in with a piece of beef in Calgary was on a hamburger at
Rocky's Burger Bus. We'll get back to the steaks, but in fact, if you have time for only one meal in Calgary, I would send you to Rocky's Burger Bus, which is, as it sounds, an old urban transit bus parked permanently in an industrial part of town. You walk up to the side of the bus, the window slides open, and you order a hamburger. This is one of the most delicious hamburgers we've eaten anywhere on this continent. It is gorgeous. It is hand-pattied. It is thick. It is made from Alberta beef. It is piled on a bun. It is crusty. It's almost, it reminded me like of good bacon, the way it was crusty. I mean, it really crunched when you bit into the outside, and the inside just ran with juice, flavor beyond all measure.
Hand-formed takes forever to come from the grill out. I mean, it seemed like to me that we were sitting there for 20 minutes.
You were just very hungry.
I was probably and probably afraid that I would get mired in the mud like the bus is. I mean, this bus looks like it's kind of half sunk into quicksand. But the burger bus is a real Calgary tradition.
Well, okay, now we've had the hamburger. What about the steaks?
Let us go higher on the bovine hog, to mix metaphors. the place I would go to eat steak, and really one of the nicest, prettiest, most romantic restaurants anywhere, is called the River Cafe, which is accessible only by foot, bicycle, or roller skate. It's on a small island that bans cars, so you have to walk to it. It's designed to be kind of like a fishing lodge, and there they serve some of the finest, what they call triple-A steak. That would be the equivalent of U.S. prime. Just sizzled to perfection. It's the way the best prime-age steak is, which is to say that it's not overly tender. You really have to slice through it, and you chew it, and that chewing just makes it blossom with flavor. I mean, it's not too tender. It's not like that kind of mass-produced prime steak that you get in those franchise steakhouses in the U.S.
In fact, it's really kind of organic beef because it's grass-raised and grain-finished compared to grain-raised cattle in the United States. And it's a very... The marbling on the steak is white.
Not yellow.
Not yellow.
Because they eat no corn.
Huh. Okay. Well, if you weren't going to eat beef... Any other places you'd suggest in Calgary?
Oh, yeah. I would go to Chicken on the Way. Now, this is the kind
chicken
of place
on
that
the
Jane
way?
And I just... Yes, it's called Chicken on the Way. It's a takeout-only chicken house. You stand in line. They have these wonderful bright yellow baskets. I think there are a few picnic tables outside. It's been there actually since the 1950s, and it's really good fast food fried chicken with terrific French fries and corn fritters
and
on the side.
If you want something other than chicken, you can get bison, you can eat musk ox, you can eat wild boar, stinging nettle soup, cedar plank wild salmon, buffalo pastrami. It's really kind of an eater's paradise.
But Jane, you forgot the best thing to finish off whatever you eat in Calgary, which is
chocolate ice cream
at Manuel Latrou. He's a Belgian candy maker who came to Calgary and uses what's that, Calibo chocolate, to make chocolate ice cream that is really just too good for words.
We each bought a pint and just sat there and ate. Each ate a pint.
Well, they don't serve it there. They buy a pint. They will give you a spoon if you buy a pint. So we just sat there and ate pints of chocolate ice cream. Very, very good.
The perfect finish to musk ox.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guidebook, Road Food. It's not a bad gift idea, guys. Now, every week, you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their road food finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And there is something new on the website. It's a weekly newsletter from me called Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about real weeknight cooking. There's a recipe to try every single week. Now, you can register for it on the site, and it is free. Check out the Splendid Table store while you're there, too. Now, it's not free, but it's full of great gift ideas, and the profits go to support the show. So check it out. All there on the site, splendidtable.org. Steve Jenkins is a hands-on cheese expert. Steve is cheesemonger at Fairway Markets in New York City, and he's author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. Steve, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Steve, can we talk American cheddars?
Oh, I love to talk about cheddar, whether it's American or English or New Zealand or Australian.
I think it may be the cheese we see the most of. And what exactly, can you explain, what is a cheddar?
Cheddar is a hideous little town in Somerset, which is in southwest England. In fact, it's so ugly that nobody goes there anymore. And no cheese is made there, so there's really no reason to go there. What is there is a gorgeous gorge outside a town that everyone visits. And all around this area of Somerset is where the farms are. Americans, being so closely related to Brits, cheddar was the first cheese made in the New World, as far back as we can tell, about 1641 of all dates that I have cemented in my memory forever. I mean, the first creature that walked off the gangplank of the first ship that came to America, whether it was Plymouth, Massachusetts, or wherever, was probably a cow. And very soon after that cow hit the shore, she had to be milked. And very soon after that, there was so much milk that they had to make some cheese out of it. And these people, the only cheese they knew how to make was cheddar, named after the hideous little village in Somerset. Cheddar is also a verb, because this original recipe that hasn't changed over all these centuries involves the milling of the curd into little tiny particles and then hand forming it into slabs. And then comes the cheddaring, which is lifting the slabs and putting them one on top of the other so that the weight of the slab upon slab forces out all of the whey. And that's why we have a cheese with such a tight, tight texture and such a waxy sort of texture. That is the process that we know as cheddaring.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to run some names by you, and I'd like to know what you think of them. These are brands you see in stores all over the country.
Sure.
Black Diamond Cheddar.
Black Diamond is the very famous Ontario cheddar. It is still very, very high quality. But what you have to understand is they're marketing a name now, not so much a cheese that I or anybody who's devoted to cheddar would jump up and down about. They're marketing the name Black Diamond. Like Kraft Cracker Barrel, Black Diamond is made all over Ontario, and all these guys do that own this huge company is buy lots of cheddar from this one or that one or the other one, and then put them away for X amount of time, be it 3 months, be it 6 months, rarely a year or more, and then charge an exorbitant price for it. I mean, things that we get from Canada are already expensive because of the duties. Now, we know the Canadian dollar is less, but the duties are so countervailing that they make Black Diamond be way, way more expensive than it should be. Anybody that's opting for Black Diamond because they think they're getting better cheddar, I think they're making a mistake. It's wonderfully good cheddar, but it's certainly no better than cheddar of the same age from any of United States states that you can buy for, heck, two-thirds to three-quarters the price.
So, all right, Steve, tell me what cheddars you think we should be tasting.
Well, I don't hesitate. I think the greatest cheddar in America or Canada is Grafton from Grafton, Vermont. It's made from raw milk, which is the most important thing about cheese making, naturally. Black Diamond is made from pasteurized milk. Cracker Barrel is made from pasteurized milk. Supermarket cheddar from Wisconsin is made from pasteurized milk. Grafton cheddar is and always has been for decades made from raw milk, from cows that are mostly raised right there in Grafton on the Grafton cheesemaking area pasturage. It's made by the same guy that's always made, a guy exactly my age who graduated from high school and started making cheese at Grafton, this fellow named Scott, who's a dreamboat. He's extremely experienced, and the result is the best cheddar in North America. And what Grafton does that nobody else does, including Shelburne, which is on the other side of Vermont and is almost, I'll sing the praises of Shelburne very, very high, but not quite as high as I sing of Grafton, because Grafton ages longer. I can sell Grafton cheddar that's aged 4 years. Unheard of for anything out of Oregon or California, which are very well known for cheddar. Unheard of for any cheddar out of Wisconsin to be that old. I never see anything out of Wisconsin, which is the most famous state for cheddar, that's more than a year old. But Grafton markets their four-star cheddar, which is 4 years old and made from raw milk. It's one of the most sublime things I've ever tasted.
What would you like us to have with these two cheddars?
I love the idea of painfully sweet dried fruit like a royal medjool date or some figs of some kind or any kind of sweet dried fruit. Even dried pineapple is delicious with cheddar. You want to counteract that acidic bite that cheddar gives you with something that's really, really sweet, as opposed to serving a hunk of cheddar with olives, which just doesn't go. Doesn't match. Cheddar's crying out for sweetness, not for savory.
Okay, we will try them. Thank you, Steve.
Always a pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is the author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve behind the cheese counter at Fairway Markets in New York City. But you can find his cheddar picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, one of America's wine heroes, Kermit Lynch. David Rosengarten picks cookbooks, and we have open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites.
The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a full-service grocery store and Target together in one stop. SuperTarget has a variety of ingredients and imported spices for those holiday recipes you want to try. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Every field has those few people who are the wise ones, the ones you turn to for guidance, for mentoring. These people have the knack of inspiring others by simply sharing their love of the work. Kermit Lynch is one of these people. He imports wine and he has a shop. In the wine world, he's almost a cult figure. Curiously, his wine shop in Berkeley, California, which he opened in 1972, sells only French wine. His French imports are found all over the United States. My favorite descriptor of Kermit Lynch is America's first hippie importer. Kermit, welcome.
Hello.
Kermit, you can practically see the Napa Valley from your shop in Berkeley. Why, pray tell, do you specialize in French wines as opposed to California?
I think there was something that appealed to me a long time ago. In fact, when I opened my business, it was a retail shop, and I, like most retail shops, I sold wines from California, from France, Italy, Spain, quite a selection, Germany too.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of years after I opened, I had the opportunity to go to France with an importer, and I just sort of, there was something there that appealed to me, that a large part of it was the tradition, that what I was tasting in France had centuries behind it. And it wasn't that I didn't like California wine. I did. I worked with Ridge, for example, and I still love Ridge wines. And
mm-hmm.
One of my best friends was a California winemaker, Joseph Swan. And in fact, he would go along with me on my early trips, because he spoke about 30 words of French and I had about 4. So he acted as my translator. But I remember when I decided to change the store and just become a French wine specialist. And one of the reasons was because Joe, I thought, made the greatest Zinfandel I'd ever tasted. And he ripped out the Zinfandel wine vines because they were too old, and replanted Pinot Noir. He took somebody's bad advice and replanted Pinot Noir, and I could not stand his Pinot Noir, and I also couldn't stand to refuse to stock his wine. I mean, here's my best friend. There would go my friendship if I told him I didn't like his wine well enough to stock it. So I made the decision. French wine only. That way I could go to him and say, no, Joe, I'm not selling any California wines anymore. And it worked. We remained friends.
You are really a friend to change, to do that for a friend. But, you know, tell me, what was it like that first time in France? I mean, what did you find?
Well, the first trip I was going, this other importer bought only from big negociant houses. So
Could you explain what a negociant is?
It's a fellow who buys wine from several sources and blends it. And he doesn't usually have his own vineyards, where a grower, this is the word we use for a small domain in France, they raise their own vines, they make their own wine, and they sell their own bottles. And there wasn't much of that back when I began in 1972-73. Anyway, that's what I was tasting. I wasn't particularly thrilled, especially when I had the chance to taste the wine of a small grower that absolutely amazed me. And it led me to try to find more like that, these small artisanal wineries.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very small production, right?
So if I find 2 or 3 cases of a good wine, I'll buy it. I don't limit myself to certain quantities, and sometimes they are small quantities like that.
2 or 3 cases
mm-hmm.
of a wine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it worth it to go through what you have to go through to ship it? I mean, obviously it is to you, but I mean, isn't that
right? These are treasures, you know. It's commercially, no, it's not. There's no reason to do it commercially. But for us winos, right. these are right. little works of art, you know.
We hear today that there's this new international style of wine.
Well, technology has permitted people everywhere, there are vines, to make a similar wine. And when I began in business in 1972, that wasn't technologically possible.
Mm-hmm.
And now that this can be done, of course, human nature is you copy whatever succeeds. You know, if Rambo 1 is a success, we'll have Rambo 2, 3, 4, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening in the wine world. It's hard to tell the difference these days between a California wine and an Australian wine, for example.
So are you having trouble finding the kinds of wines that you prefer, that you believe in?
Well, there's a backlash to all this. But I'll tell you the strange thing about the market to me right now is that those sort of robot wines that all taste alike cost more than these small production wines that have a lot of individuality and a lot of character.
Hmm. Well, Kermit, what would you have us taste?
Well, I think today one of the most interesting regions where I'm buying is in southern France. And if you try, for example, a Côte du Rhône wine, that's a label that usually will run you only about $10 to $15 a bottle, and you can get a wonderful wine for that.
Any other areas in France?
Well, the white wines from the Loire Valley, like Sancerre, Puy-Fumé, Vouvray, those are really overlooked because of the Chardonnay craze, so there's bargains there, too. It's sort of, the rule in wine is, if you want a bargain, look where nobody else is looking. If you follow the fad, you're going to pay
a lot of money.
More than you need to for a good bottle of wine.
Exactly. Kermit, thank you.
My pleasure.
Wine importer Kermit Lynch is author of Adventures in the Wine Trade. David Rosengarten has done it all, or nearly all. He's co-authored a groundbreaking book on pairing wine with food. He was a pioneer on the Food Network. He's done several cookbooks, and now he has a newsletter where he critiques food. It's called The Rosengarten Report. And we're lucky enough to have David stop by the Splendid Table regularly. Hey, David, welcome back.
Hello, Lynn.
David, you know, you're the man who tastes everything, goes everywhere. What do you want for the holidays?
I want to take a break from tasting. I want to sit down and read a good book. No, that's not strictly true. But I am thinking literary thoughts this season. And the thoughts were provoked by the fact that I recently became aware that the man who is perhaps the world's most visible chef right now, the superstar of the entire gastronomic planet, is Alain Ducasse in France. Of course, he's got a restaurant in the U.S. now in New York. He's got about a dozen restaurants all around the world, and the excellence of his restaurants is amazing, how he keeps it up. But to make it all even more astonishing, he has published about a dozen cookbooks over the last 10 years. I mean, I don't know how he does it.
Yeah, yeah.
But And not only has he published them, it's like, yeah, we'll throw a few recipes in. No, it's not like that at all. They are all distinct, unique, idiosyncratic, individual, and some of them are absolutely terrific. I wouldn't be without them. There are 7 of the books that are in English and available in the U.S. I've gone through them all, and I've picked out my 2 or 3 faves.
Oh, okay. You've got to tell me. What are they?
Well, tell you what, little drama. Let's work up to the favorite.
Okay.
The third favorite is a book called Harvesting Excellence, which was very cunningly timed. It came out just about the time that he opened last year in New York, opened his restaurant. This is a big coffee table book. It's a paean to the ingredients of America. It's a fascinating reading about all the good American things, the best breads and cheeses and stone crabs and venison and meats and vegetables. And it's great to read about it from the point of view of a man who certainly knows his good things in France. There's no recipes in this book, but lots of photos, and it's really a terrific read. One level up for me is a big book called L'Atelier of Alain Ducasse, which means, of course, the workshop of Alain Ducasse. Mm-hmm. He has chosen five great chefs who have trained with him over the years along the way, and he has picked out ingredients, and he has asked each chef to do his own interpretation of those ingredients. And you read about the ingredients and you see the differences in style, and it's all very meticulous. For example, for all the Ducasse recipes, like one for sea bass steaks with leeks, potatoes, and truffles, there's a total of 17 color photos to help you along the way as you make the recipe. This is definitely a book to cook with. But in addition to that, there's a lot of thoughtful material in here. There's a French intellectual. His name is Jean-François Ravel. He's written this fabulous essay which attempts to put Ducasse in historical context. And then there's a 40-page section about products and producers that is so illuminating and wonderful. Now, if you have to buy just one, especially if you're a traveler, here's the one that I would buy. It's called Provence of Alain Ducasse. You know, when I looked at it, I thought, whatever. But once I got into it, I was absolutely astounded, because this is like Frommer's by Alain Ducasse. It is an in-depth guide to traveling through the south of France, but it's so in-depth. It's like list after list. You turn the page, there's the best markets in which to find tomatoes. Turn the page. There's the greatest olive oil mills in Provence, with all the travelers' details, like what hours they're open. The best sleepy villages to visit. The best museums and gardens. The best places to go for an aperitif. 21 of them across the region. And perhaps the most exciting thing of all, he takes 55 different Provençal ingredients or dishes, like, let's say, ratatouille, and he tells you what he thinks is the best place in Provence to get that thing.
I've got to have this book.
I know. It's ravishing.
I want all three. David, thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Huh. Thank you, Lynn.
Yet another way to spend my hard-earned cash. Well, David Rosengarten is creator of the newsletter, The Rosengarten Report. That, by the way, is another nice gift idea. For information on everything, go to the website, splendidtable.org. And I can't resist. I've got my 2 cents worth about books for gifts, too. Now, here's some that I like that I think might be overlooked. For the cook who doesn't have a lot of time, check out Local Flavors by Deborah Madison. I think she's the master of great-tasting, easy dishes. On the non-cookbook side of things, I've got two books for history buffs. One is a delicious look at the history of dining by an art historian. It's Apples of Gold in Settings of Silver, Stories of Dinner as a Work of Art, and it's by Carolyn Young. The other is, I think, one of the best scholarly works that I have seen on pasta to date. It is called Pasta, the Story of a Universal Food. Now, we're going to put information on this up on the website. This is the time of year for baking. Now, you may never go near a sack of flour 11 months out of the year, but if you're ever going to bake something, now's the time. Well, we have some help for you. Here in the studio with me is the editor-in-chief of Fine Cooking Magazine, Martha Holmberg. Martha, welcome.
Thank you. I'm a perfect example of who you're just talking about. I love to bake at this time of year.
Well, let's talk about baking tips, because I think there are things that are really helpful to people, especially if they don't bake often. For instance, could you talk to me about how you measure, especially flour?
This is incredibly important, and even a lot of people who do bake a lot, they don't think about it. But we, on the receiving end of lots of recipes, realize the huge range that you can get when you measure flour. There are a couple of things, but first of all, my heartfelt advice to anybody who wants to become a better baker is get a scale, those little kitchen scales, and measure your flour using weight instead of volume. Because when you measure by volume, things can change depending on how you get the flour in the measuring cup.
Uh-huh.
You know, some people, they take the measuring cup and they scoop it in the bag of flour. Well, what they're doing is they're compacting a lot of flour into that measuring cup by the pressure. Other people take a spoon and spoon it into the measuring cup, let the flour just kind of flow into the measuring cup and level it off. That's really the correct way to measure flour. And that's the way that most recipe writers will be measuring their flour. And so if you're doing the scoop, you're going to get a lot more flour, and your dough is going to be stiffer, it's going to be drier, you're not going to get the right results.
Okay, you know, a lot of times you bake a pie, and the recipe says, bake the pie shell empty,
mm-hmm.
and then it shrinks, mm-hmm. and you can't get all the filling mm-hmm. into it. So how do you avoid that?
Well, there are a couple of things, and the main thing is that you don't want to stretch your dough. There's this stuff in pie dough and in any kind of pastry dough called gluten
mm-hmm.
that it's like elastic, and if you stretch it out, it's going to shrink back, and it may do that slowly during baking rather than right before your eyes. So when you lay that sheet of dough in there, don't try to stretch it to the edge. Just let it kind of drape on its own will right in there, and then, you know, lift the edges over.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing, because I think people do tend to stretch a little, especially if you don't quite roll your circle large enough. You know, it's a little bit shy, and you're like, let's just pull it over the edge here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, anchor it on. But another interesting thing that we discovered in our test kitchen is that the Pyrex pie pans mm-hmm. tend to make your dough shrink a little bit more versus a metal pie pan. Because what happens with a metal pie pan, the heat is conducted very quickly through that metal, because it's a good conductor, right to the pie dough, and it sets it really quickly before it has a chance to start shrinking.
Ah.
Whereas the Pyrex, which is, you know, thicker and the glass is not a very good conductor of heat, the dough has time to start reacting in the heat and shrinking before it's actually set firm enough that it can't move anymore.
Okay, back to the metal pie pan.
Uh-huh.
Substitutions.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas for, I'm out of one thing. Can I use something
else?
Well,
it's tricky in baking time because there are certain things that, you know, you have to have the right kind of flour. Don't use whole wheat if your recipe calls for cake flour.
Mm-hmm.
It won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, in my mind, there's no substitute for butter.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one nifty place that a lot of times you get caught short. You go to pull your brown sugar out, and there's just a little tiny bit left in the box. You don't have enough. You can make brown sugar using white sugar and molasses, because that's really what brown sugar is. Most sugar makers now, they actually go ahead and make the regular refined granulated sugar, and then they just add molasses back. So you can do that at home.
Uh-huh. What's the proportion?
For about one cup of white sugar, put about 3 to 4 tablespoons of molasses, and just do a little bit at a time so you don't overdo it. And I do it in the food processor. So throw your white sugar in, start spinning,
mm-hmm.
and just drizzle a little bit of the molasses in, and you'll see it'll start taking on that more kind of sandy, clumpy, wet feeling that a brown sugar has.
Do-aheads. What can I do ahead?
So much. You can do so much ahead. And this is also really key to holiday, because a lot of us, myself included, get overambitious of, I'm going to do 50 cookies and all these pies. And then when it comes down to it at the last minute, you don't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
But almost every cookie dough can be made ahead and frozen, especially something like a slice and bake or a roll cookie,
mm-hmm.
A bar cookie. You know, you can just make it ahead and freeze it and then bake it off when you're ready. Pie doughs especially, because for pie making, a lot of the anxiety comes in actually making the pastry,
mm-hmm.
the filling, you know, an apple pie filling or whatever. Those are easy. So you can, when you have a quiet moment, make up several batches of pie dough, put it in plastic, put it in the freezer. You can even roll it out and line your pie pan and put it in the freezer if you want to. And then it's ready to go. And also cake layers freeze beautifully and they're ready to go.
Martha Holmberg, thank you.
My pleasure.
Martha Holmberg is editor-in-chief of Fine Cooking Magazine. All her tips are in the winter 2003 issue. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Here's the question. What once-famous restaurant guide started on the back of a Christmas card? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target store all in one. Now, in addition to a complete Target store, Super Target features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the Super Target nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what once famous restaurant guide started on the back of a Christmas card? Well, it was Adventures in Good Eating, and the card was from the country's first best-selling restaurant critic. In fact, because of the guide, this person became one of the most trusted people in America. His name was Duncan Hines, and no, in spite of the fact that it's on a line of cake mixes, he never baked anything in his entire life. Hines started out as a traveling salesman who used to scribble notes about the restaurants he visited, especially the ones he wanted to be sure he never went back to. In 1935, he put this list on the back of his Christmas cards. Well, everybody wanted a copy. So by 1936, he published his first pocket guide, Adventures in Good Eating. Now, personally, I've always liked Hines' style of writing. In one review, he wrote, "If the soup had been as warm as the wine, if the wine had been as cold as the turkey, and if the turkey had had a breast like the waitress, it would have been a swell dinner."
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. Let's see who is up. We've got Pamela on the line. So, Pamela, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, I'm calling from Carmel, Indiana. And, you know, in Indiana, it's kind of hard to get seafood here all the time.
Right.
And but we have a really, really wonderful fish market, but it's a good ways from where I live. But two or three times a month, I stop by there at the fish market and buy whatever they have on special. And then on the way home, I call my boyfriend, I tell him what I have, and he finds a great recipe for us to make with it.
This is a good team.
And so a few weeks ago, I get home, and he's got a spicy Caribbean fish dish that he has in mind.
Right.
But it has an ingredient that we've never heard of before, and we can't find it.
What's the ingredient?
And the ingredient is annatto seeds.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And not easy to find. They're also, you know, they're also called achiote. I think it's A-C-H-I-O-T-E.
That's right.
They're very popular in the Caribbean where they grow. And they're used in, at times in Mexico and in and the northern part of South America, you know, and in Central America. And they're like, I remember them being almost like little nibs. They're small and they're very hard. And they're this really russet orange color.
Okay.
And a lot of times you'll see them used with oil. People will take the seeds and they'll just warm them in oil or saute them in oil. And the oil turns this rich yellow red.
Ooh, yes.
And it has, I never think of annatto having a strong flavor. I mean, I haven't tasted it in ages, but what vaguely comes to mind is something that tastes rather herbal with a little hint of pepper behind it. But I have no doubt people who are using it more regularly are going to, you know, be thinking I'm a little off. But it's a gentle flavor. It's not it's not a flavor that stands up and slaps you over the head. But,
okay.
But it's often made, you know, used in an oil form, and then you would use it when you cook rice and you saute chicken. I mean, there's arroz con pollo, a famous rice and chicken dish, and there's a version of it probably in every part of the Caribbean. And you get this gorgeous golden, you know, sort of orangey color from it. There's also another sauce that's done with it that you baste, you marinate pork in this, and then you baste with it. And it's where you mix it with sour orange juice or lemon and orange juice and garlic and oil. And you use that as a marinade, and that's also sometimes used on fish.
Well, ooh, that sounds wonderful.
So what you're talking about is this is something that's going to turn your fish a beautiful color, give it a slight hint, a very subtle hint of spice, and really set off things like tart and sweet flavors, orange and lemon. If you have any spiciness, like a little bit of chili, it's a nice thing to add. So now there's a couple of sources. I'm thinking if you go up on the net to ethnicgrocer.com, they've got to carry it. And then, you know, any Hispanic shop, anybody that's selling Latin American ingredients is going to be probably be carrying it.
I see. And I just go in and ask for annatto seed.
Yes, or achiote. Yeah, and another source might be Penzi's Spices. They're also up on the net.
Okay.
Yeah, and the other thing is there's actually a paste made from it, too. But I'd say go for the seeds because you can always whirl them in a blender. You know, you make the annatto oil, and then you can whirl that in a blender. It's a fun thing to have around the house. You're going to find you'll use it more, you know, you'll use it a lot. I remember one way I used it. I did it in olive oil, and then I cooked scrambled eggs in it.
Oh, fun!
And they, yeah, just remembered this. And then we put chopped, you know, scallion on top of it. It was dynamite. It looked like nothing on earth. It was really wonderful.
Oh, that's cool. Well, thank you so much for shedding.
Hey, you are welcome, and keep experimenting. I love it.
Will do.
Okay.
Okay. Bye bye.
Take care. 800-537-5252. We love to hear your voice on that answering machine. Give us a call. We've got Jeff calling. So Jeff, hi.
Hi, I'm calling from Monterey, California.
Uh-huh.
I am a big fan of Japanese food.
Right.
And I, in addition to sushi, I love a good bowl of miso soup.
Right.
And about 3 years ago, I finally decided, why don't I try to make it instead of just enjoying it in a restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
I bought some miso paste at a health food store. I want you to know I did this about three times.
Yeah.
The results went from slightly disappointing and salty to downright gross. I have no idea what I did. I've never gotten a Japanese cookbook, but I followed the recipe on the package. I need help. What do you do to make a good bowl of miso soup?
Oh.
What do they do in Japanese restaurants?
You know what you did? You did exactly what I did years ago. And I said, what is the fuss? This doesn't taste anything like what I've had. I had the exact same experience.
Not at all. The salty, pasty blech.
I know. And there were so many different flavored misos, you know, and none of them worked.
I think I tried three different ones at three different stores.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I'll tell you something. I'll tell you what I learned. It's not the miso. It's that we were missing a vital ingredient. Evidently, most Japanese miso soups start with a broth that is called dashi, and then you add the miso to that broth.
Oh, dashi with a D?
D-A, D as in David, A-S-H-I.
Okay.
And that is a broth that, and it takes seconds to make it.
Oh, good.
But you can also get instant dashi, and I've been told by a friend of mine who's a Japanese food expert that most Japanese these days go to the store and they buy an instant dashi powder. But if you want to really be a purist, it's made from a combination of dried bonito flakes.
Oh, yeah, the little fish.
Yeah, and a special seaweed. I can't remember the name of the seaweed, but the idea is, and you cook these, I think you cook the seaweed first and you never let it boil, something like that. You pull it out. I did this once. You pull it out and then you add the flakes of the bonito and you let them sit for maybe 20 minutes and then you just strain that and that's dashi.
Oh.
But what it comes down to is, this is what I do remember. And when you're saying this, it's making me want to go home and do this. Is that it's about 3 to 4 cups of dashi to about a quarter cup of a miso.
3 to 4 cups of dashi to a quarter cup of miso.
Right. And the thing is, the miso is sort of flavoring the dashi.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's really the dashi that has the...
That's right. The miso is wonderful, and you can, you know, with depending on the kind of miso you use, the soup will change.
Uh-huh.
But what you and I fell in love with... was that
and not this thing we made at home?
I know.
Now, did you make a better version, basically?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh,
it suddenly tasted the way it was supposed to taste.
I was hoping that there would be this magic ingredient.
Well, the magic ingredient, and you know, get an instant dashi to start out, and then if you get really, and by the way, there's some really good Japanese cookbooks, and to me. One of the best ones, and I can never tell you the name of the author because I murder the name, but I think it's called something like The Simple Art of Japanese Cooking, and it came out in the 1980s. So check like secondhand book sites, you know, like check Amazon and Half.com. It is one of those things. I know zip about Japanese cooking, but whenever I need information, this person explains it so wonderfully. It's not just the recipe, it's the backdrop.
Oh, good, which is needed.
Yeah, which saved my life.
Uh-huh. I think you're saving my miso soup desire life also.
See, don't blame the miso. It's just, you know, we didn't have all the formula to put together.
Okay.
Hey, Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Okay,
bye.
Miso's a wonderful thing, but it needs a balance, we've learned. Reach us at 800-537-5252. David's calling. David, what pressing issue do you want to discuss?
Tandoori tuna instead of tandoori chicken.
Huh.
There's a good supply of it locally, and I'd like to try to do something like that.
You mean someone is making it locally?
Well, no, tuna is available.
Aha. Uh-huh. Where do you live?
In North Carolina.
Hi, you're getting good tuna. This is good. This is great. Mm-hmm. Now, why tandoori? I'm curious.
It just seems that with the texture of the flesh, it might come out nice.
Yeah. Well, let me explain. You know, you probably know this, but you know, tandoori is a technique, but it's also a cooking instrument.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, it's the chicken is the skin is removed and it's marinated in a spice and yogurt marinade, and then it's suspended in this very hot clay oven.
Right.
Right. And I think, I mean, I wouldn't do tuna exactly that same way because I think tuna is going to dry out very quickly.
Okay.
But now wait, we're not going to give up. We can do what we would call tandoori style tuna.
Okay.
Because tuna is robust. You know, I think you've nailed a great idea here. Tuna is very robust. It would take to the marinating with the yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have an idea of how to do the yogurt marinade?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
Okay. So what I would do is do the yogurt marinade, take some chunks of tuna, you know, something about an inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
But don't leave it overnight the way you would the chicken. I would leave it maybe for a couple of hours in the refrigerator.
Okay.
And then what I do is I would do a slow sauté of it.
Okay.
And what's going to happen is you're going to get crustiness on the outside. You keep the tuna a bit underdone in the middle. Because
right.
I think well-done tuna, frankly...
Well, that kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sort of does. It sort of does. And so I do a slow sauté, though, and I leave it, you know, a bit pink in the middle. And I think you'll get lovely flavor. It's not tandoori, but it's the tandoori spicing and the yogurt. Yeah, and I think that would be super.
Okay.
So take it, you know, just slow cook.
Very good. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
That's exactly what I need now.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Angie is calling. Angie, what would you like to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I was wondering about vanilla extract. I was wondering if you know how it's made and if it's possible to make a good-tasting one at home.
I've sort of fooled around with it. I don't know if I've made the best, but
mm-hmm.
essentially it's alcohol
mm-hmm.
and vanilla beans that are steeped. You know, you split the vanilla beans and you steep them. Sometimes I've always wondered if they don't grind the vanilla. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I've thought you could probably throw them in the blender. And then you let that sit for a week or more in a cool, dark place, and then you strain it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure of the proportions, but, you know, my theory with something like vanilla is more is better.
Yes.
More is better. Could it be as good as what we can buy? I think it depends on the quality of the vanilla beans.
Yeah.
You need a neutral alcohol. And if you can get it in a liquor store, something like, I think it's called grain alcohol. It's an alcohol that people use to make homemade liqueurs.
Hmm. Because
that's completely neutral, has no taste.
Okay. Because, yeah, I think I've heard you can use vodka, and I was surprised because every vanilla that I like, it's usually made with bourbon.
Yeah, and if you like the bourbon, you know, the word bourbon on the vanilla bottle?
Uh-huh.
That's not the liquor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know what it is? I can't remember the whole story. It's the name of the French royal family that was in power, I think, when vanilla came into vogue. And the vanilla bean is actually, I think, that particular bean is called a bourbon bean.
Okay.
But by the way, putting lots of vanilla beans in rum
mm-hmm.
or bourbon, it tastes different than normal extract, but that's a killer flavoring
yeah,
in anything.
Yeah, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it could be delicious, but I wouldn't go with the vodka or the gin because they have a flavor that I don't think works with vanilla at all.
Yeah, okay.
So
look for grain alcohol.
Right, and get really good vanilla beans. They have to be really fragrant vanilla
yeah.
beans. And then see what happens.
Okay.
All right?
Great. Thank you. I love your show, Lynn.
Hey, thank you, dear. And by the way, that would be a great Christmas gift to give, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Holiday gift?
True.
Yeah. Great idea.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Let us know how it turns out, Angie.
I will.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye. I have a little bit of sad news. A phenomenal bread baker, a man who was considered to be the person who essentially inspired the whole artisan bread movement in this country, Lionel Poilin, was killed in a helicopter accident at the end of October. And there are two stories I've got to share with you. First of all, back in the days when we had a Cold War and the Soviet Union was going strong, evidently a news team from Moscow came to film the decadent life of the French in Paris. And what no one had told them was that in France, most bakeries bake bread every several hours and people stand on line waiting for the freshest bread. Well, they filmed the line outside of the Poilin bakery, stating that it showed how, in spite of all the propaganda, the French were starving and they were standing on line begging for bread. Well, I stood on that same line late one New Year's Eve evening. We were on our way to a party and it was absolutely stone cold. We were all waiting for the last baking. It was dark. It was one of those incredibly, well, it was a magical night. Imagine Paris on New Year's Eve, but everybody was freezing. And down the line came young Lionel and his father, and they had these big trays of these rustic apple turnovers. They were hot from the oven, and they were passing them out, wishing us all Happy New Year, thanking us for being so patient, and saying, here are hand warmers. So we will miss Lionel Poilin, but we can hope that the bakery will continue. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, you can call us at any time. Number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from the late and great Irma Bombeck. A true friend never defends a husband who gets his wife an electric skillet for Christmas. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Now be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. There's some great gift ideas, including a brunch box that pretty much exists because of a divine bacon. All the proceeds go to support this very show. So take a look. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for being with us. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.